The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, Father Ray Kelly joined me in studio alongside dance partner Kylie Vincent after he bowed out of the Dancing with the Stars quarterfinals on Sunday night. Irishman Cameron O'Connor lives and works in Singapore, and he told me about the efforts to tackle the coronavirus there as the world grapples to contain the spread of the virus. Marion Rees talked to me about the devastating effect that a hit and run had on her family after her two brothers were struck by a car and killed in 1987. Yvonne Redden told me about the concept of social prescribing, which looks to support in the community to improve people's health and well-being. And Ian Dowling is an Irish picker, and he told me about how modern-day treasure hunting has become his bread and butter. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Yes, yes. Father Ray Kelly, good morning.
Good morning.
And your dance partner, Kylie Vincent, good morning.
Morning.
And welcome to you both. As I said there, that little piece of music will haunt you for the rest of your life.
I guess it will, for a long time anyway, yeah.
First things first, how are you feeling this morning?
I'm feeling good, yeah. I suppose, you know, I know you expected me to be here maybe 7 or 8 weeks ago.
And I've said as much.
And you did as well, yeah.
I said as much. I'm not going to lie to you.
I'm not sure whether to apologise here or not for not turning up.
I probably should have apologised for being a smartass.
But, I mean, the people spoke. And that's why I'm only here now.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you
very
much.
I mean, hand on heart, I did think you were going to be the second one in, if not the first in. And because I think you probably bettered me in my best efforts in the toy show. But nevertheless, I thought we'd see you because your other half had come in the first day.
Yes, he did, unfortunately.
And I said, I'm going to meet your other half tomorrow or the next week. But how wrong was I? So how would you characterise your experience in the last number of weeks?
It's been just an amazing experience, the whole thing. You know, I think signing up for the whole programme and the whole reality show,
yeah,
I probably took on a lot more than I actually could chew, in a sense of that, you know, I didn't realise there was so much intensity and training involved. And as the weeks went on, it got more and more and more. But the people were keeping me there. And I was just thinking last night, God, if I'm not in the dance-off tonight. And I was so tired last night. I was so
you
tired.
Banjaxed?
I was, yeah.
Yeah,
I was
to use
really,
the word.
I was, yeah. And I said, even to my, I'm not sure that I say it to you, Kylie, I'm not sure. And I was supposed to start rehearsing in another half hour
today.
For this week.
Yeah.
And I said, God, Kylie, I'm not sure if I can see you at 10 o'clock in the morning. And part of me was so happy to be doing the dance-off last night. But mostly I was happy for Ryan, and this is honest to God truth.
Go on.
The four people who are there now in the semi-final, I was so thrilled that it was them.
Yes.
I swear in my heart, hand in heart, that I am so, so happy it's them, not me, because they're the dancers. I'm the entertainer, okay?
Yeah.
But I also, you know, if I was there, it would be for the people who kept me there. And I think being there for 10 weeks, I think I did them justice as well.
Why do you think they kept voting you in?
Because I think they love me. I think they love me. They love my. They love the smile. They love the way I dance, which isn't great. They just loved it. It was an entertainment show as well as a dance show. And I think I just gave that little bit of entertainment. Yeah. And I suppose the other side of it was, you know, Priest, you know, and all that, you know, never has been seen in Irish television before. And maybe never will again.
Well, who knows?
Well, who knows exactly. But I think, you know, that was different. And because of that, I think that's the whole thing. I was kept there because of that. They saw a different element to the priesthood, maybe by the fact that what I was doing.
Give me a high point, low point. What was the highest point of the whole experience?
The highest point of the whole experience really was, you know, realising that, you know, all the emails and messages that came in to me after the negative stuff that had come in. And I've put all the negative stuff now way down the sinkhole at this stage, you know. But I was in a low quell for a while. I really was.
What happened?
I was just feeling physically, I had a sciatica in my left leg, which developed just a week after I started dancing. And then after that, there was a few letters and emails and cards, anonymously, most of them. Mm. And then there was one of the nastiest phone calls that ever came to anybody in their whole life, came my way as well. And that just floored me completely.
Did you take the call?
What happened was I took a call at 7:30 in the evening, and it was a Kerry Cork accent, that's for sure. And just this man asked to speak to Father Ray Kelly. And I was, for some reason, I got suspicious. And I says, oh, he's not here. Can I take a message? Well, you tell him from me, he's nothing but a bleep forever, the F word. Dancer, singer, priest, parish, fat effing belly dancing around the floor. All those negative stuff, housekeeper even, parochial house, and he laughing through it all. He laughing. It was large, you know. And I just, and I said, yeah, can I take your name? And he gave me his name. Well, he gave me a name. And I said, yeah, I'll pass on the message. And about 10 o'clock that night then, I went into my messages on the phone, and there was three or four. And it was the very same litany. He had obviously left it earlier on the phone as well. Mm. And when I went into the company Shinawil on a Saturday and told them the story, I said, look, pull me out of this. I can't take it anymore. I've had enough. So we talked and we talked and we talked. And then they said, report that call to the Gardaí. And I did that as well. And they came.
How did you feel that night after listening to the messages and the call?
I just felt at an all-time low. I felt this was the wrong thing for me to do. And then, you know, I just felt, it was just eating at me. It was just, And luckily I have my family to phone up and support, and my nieces and nephews. And they said, look, don't mind the big grudgers. Don't let that get you. You rise above this.
Because it wasn't just that call you talk about. There were others, in the parish who were talking to journalists and saying, you know, he shouldn't have been up there. He should have been doing mass. He should have been doing funerals. He had another role in life. What the hell is he doing dancing around and dancing with the stars? And they just didn't get it. They didn't get that you could do both.
But I was doing both.
Yeah.
I was doing both.
Yeah.
You know, I was there for weddings. I was there for funerals. I was there for baptisms. I was there for everything, you know. And Kylie, you know, and eventually it was because I was doing both, it became so tiring that I went to the company as well. And I said, is there any way? And they said, is there anything we can do to help you to stay in this show? And I said, well, would it be possible if I wasn't traveling up to Dublin so much? And they arranged for Kylie to come down to teach me 2 days a week in Oldcastle.
I started the programme by talking about a guest we had on The Late Late Show, Barry Keoghan, great Irish actor.
Yeah.
And how people are savage online to people who are talented or kind because they don't think twice.
Yeah.
And he's a young man with a massive future. You're not necessarily, you're not an old man, but you're not a youngster like
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
My point is this, regardless of what age you are or what position you have in life, whether you're on TV or you're a kid in a class, meanness, cruelty, trolling, it's just not fair.
It's not fair. It never stops.
Well, why can't people simply just, if they don't like what you do, say it in a civil way? What happened to civility?
Yeah, exactly. What happened to civility? What is wrong with these people that they feel they need to do this?
On a brighter note, okay, because let's not feed that beast because they love that. That's
absolutely.
When they're in their basements,
doing
what they do to themselves, and like that's their problem. We're here to celebrate the good news, and the good news is that you did bring a gaiety to the nation.
Yeah.
I found myself on a Sunday going, this bio, here he comes again. And actually, you were the point in many ways that I sat up and said, here he comes now, because between you. Kylie, God help her. I mean, she
absolutely. She's a saint.
She was like Matt Talbot.
Wandering
around the streets of Dublin with the chains and the cross on her back.
If I could write to Pope Francis now and I'd get her canonized straight away, I definitely would.
But he'd only be able to send you a video in return. But he'd be like, are you all right?
Oh yeah,
are
definitely.
Are you all right, Kylie?
Yeah. No, look, he comes out every Sunday. He gives it his best, and that's all I could have ever asked for. So yeah, no, he should definitely be proud.
How did you feel? Where are you from originally?
I'm from South Africa.
And how did you feel when you were told that you were going to be dancing in Ireland, and not only that, but with a priest?
Well, to be honest, I was actually very excited because it's my first time doing something like Dancing with the Stars. And when we first met, I knew we were going to have fun straight away. I knew, oh, this is going to be a good one. definitely loads of challenges that were unexpected.
And when he hit the wall of cruelty, how did you feel about him and you as a professional dancer? How did you manage that?
Do you know, I knew it was so hard for Ray. But at the end of the day, you know, we just, when we said we're going to forget about it, we're going out there for ourselves, we're going to have fun. That's our goal. We weren't, you know, wanting higher scores. We weren't wanting anything from the public. It was purely just for Ray to go out there, enjoy himself and know that he gave his best. You know, that's all I can ask for from, like, as a teacher, dancer, trainer. You just want someone to give their best.
Which you...
I did, yeah, I did. But I mean, she was when I hit, you mentioned the wall of cruelty, Kylie was the first that got it because I walked in on a Thursday.
Yeah.
Come on, Ray. And I love her South African accent because I worked in South Africa for a few
years. Oh, I didn't know that, okay.
And when I heard it was going to be a lady from South Africa who was going to see me, I said, yippee. And, I, you know, her voice, her accent haunts me. Come on, Ray. Good job, Ray. You know, this kind of lovely. And I just love it. But when she was the first that got the wall of cruelty and I walked in, come on, Ray. I looked at her. Tears started coming and I said, Kylie, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. We need to talk. We need to talk. We sat down and we talked.
Talking is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't help you if you don't voice, you know, how you feel. Yeah. And
I just hate that they got you. I hate that they got you.
They didn't get me fully. No,
well,
only
but
for a while.
It was temporary. I know. Yeah. But I'm sorry that happened to you. I think I'm sorry to anyone listening this morning they get. Because it's just, it's bullying by other means. But anyway, I don't want to give them all that time and credit because they deserve none of them. Right. Let's take some comments from the people because you said the people have spoken and they continue to speak. And I'll do a flavour of these and then you can decide whether you like what you hear or not. Right, Aidan Dempsey in Castle Knox says, I think Father Ray was wonderful in a breath of fresh air around the prevailing Catholic Church perception. At a time when priests tend to hide their identification, I was particularly impressed with his bravery in making no secret of his vocation. Shame on the begrudgers and well done, Ray. Another from Leitrim, Kieran Tracy said, it seems to me that as a priest, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Father Ray, how do you deal with the begrudgers? Delighted Father Ray Kelly was voted out, says Eamon in Waterford. He can now spend more time preaching off the altar about bullying, which is, I think, a double-handed something there. Yeah. I think, but ultimately, you can actually probably use that altar to talk about bullying and nastiness and everything like that, because it's not kids on phones. It's actually adults are as bad, leading by poor example. Father Ray entertained us every week. He made us smile. Both he and Kylie made a lovely team and we will miss you on the show. Love, Ray. Thank you for cheering us up every Sunday and keep on dancing. Well done, Father Ray. It was a pleasure to watch. While I love Lottie and Ryan, who are dancers for many years, Ryan was a backing dancer. Well, okay, credit needs to be given to Grania, Aidan, and others who've never had training. Did Father Ray lose any weight during the time or did he get fitter? You can answer that now if you like.
Yeah, I got fitter and I lost about 10 pounds.
I wanted to say, that's a great answer, Operation Dance Formation. Paul in Cork says, I wanted to say a massive thank you to Father Ray and to Kylie, which is nice. They have been nothing but first class in week in, week out, a breath of fresh air and brought so much joy to the show. You should be proud of yourself. Look, I could be here all day reading these, but essentially they're all saying really lovely things. Yeah. And these are you know, probably more real people than the dungeon dwellers. Yeah. To see Father Ray, who can't dance as well as some, improve and keep trying was just lovely and part of what the show is about. I love seeing what he was going to be able to do and how far he was going to improve. He was a joy. And whoever says Tom Limerick selected the dancer should have known at first glance that Father Ray couldn't dance. Why put the poor man through all of that?
Do you want me to answer that?
Yeah.
Well, I think most of the people who were invited to do the show admit they couldn't dance very well, you know. And I think the purpose of the show is not to have, I mean, if you invited all pro dancers onto the show, it wouldn't be much of a show, would it?
That's a very good response. And I think we'll take that. Can I ask you, because you joined the priesthood quite late in life, didn't you?
I was, yeah.
How old were you?
I was 28 when I went to the seminary, so I was 36 when I was ordained.
And why the delay?
I was working for about 10 years. And, you know, initially, leaving cert time, I thought about priesthood, but then I went on to work and there was money coming into my pocket and I said, oh,
what were you working in?
I was a civil servant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said, I want money in my pocket and I want a car and I want a house and I want to do the normal things, which I did do, except that I didn't find a girl who would love me enough to marry me and vice versa.
You, well, why did you join the priesthood then? If you're looking for a girl to marry,
I know
that's
yeah,
the last
yeah,
place well, you need to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, but I mean,
of all the reasonings and all the world,
I know,
Ray.
Yeah, yeah. But strangely, you know, other things intervened then, and I remember it was the time Pope John Paul came to Ireland, and I was very moved by that experience. And we went over the following year, and you know, you just never know how things happen to you. Sometimes influence your life that you're not even aware of at the time, but happen, you know, kind of gradually progress, you know.
Well, that's a vocation then,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly it, yeah.
And you got the calling and you joined the priesthood.
I joined the missionary priesthood, and after 7 years, I went to work in her country,
in South Africa. Whereabouts in South Africa?
A place called Zanine, the Northern Transvaal area.
And what sort of work were you doing out
there? I was in a parish. I was working in, it was the cathedral parish at the time. There was an Irish bishop, Hugh Slattery, I think he's retired since, Sacred Heart Bishop, that was his order. And, you know, I mean, in a sense of that, my parish was probably the size of Westmeath and Meath put together, with two priests.
Yeah.
And this is probably, and I say this now because probably we're heading this way in Ireland.
Yes.
And my diocese was probably the size of Leinster. And we got on with it. So there was mass once a month in different stations, and we went out to the places and did the baptisms, the weddings, the funerals, whatever, once a month, and that was it.
Okay. And looking at things like I see the tissues out. The coronavirus, as you're wiping your nose, let me ask you, how are you feeling?
Just have a runny nose.
anytime somebody winks sideways, got the virus.
We've become paranoid about it now.
Totally. Every door handle I see is like a monster looking at me, going, touch me. How are you dealing with things like mass and weddings and funerals and the virus? What have you
the only direction we got really was from the bishops' conference, and from they got a lot from the HSC to say that, you know, we cut out the shaking of the hands, for example.
That's gone. Yeah,
receiving Holy Communion on the tongue, take it on the hand rather than the tongue.
Yeah.
And I know somebody was one priest was on, I'm not sure it was your show or Ray Darcy's show the other day, and he said he put 13 or 14 sanitizers going into his church, and within an hour they were down to about two. They were gone.
They were robbed.
Yeah, yeah. So there's not much point in doing that either, you know.
You have to nail everything down.
But
now,
you mentioned carbolic soap earlier, and I have a pile of carbolic soap at home in my house, so I really should distribute it around the parish.
Yeah. That's some proper missionary work now.
Yeah, exactly.
Listening to Father Ray says a text, I could hear the hurt in his voice at the idiocy and cruelty of his critics, and we could all learn a lot from him. I think that comment I read earlier on about preaching from the altar about it, you could probably do something with this experience, whatever about the dancing, but also the meanness. And you can only battle cruelty with kindness.
Yeah.
Because kindness is king.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So there could be, I feel a sermon coming on.
Yeah. Well, when I was staying overnight last night, I met a man this morning, and he was going off to a school. He says, congratulations, I'm going off to a school now where there's a lot of bullying going on, and I'm trying to sort a bit out. So, I mean, you know, it's at that level. It's from, you know, knee high to a grasshopper up.
And all the way up. Let's be very honest, says John Corcoran in Cork. Father Ray's participation was one of the best pieces of light entertainment I have viewed. He was honest, brave, and most of all, the people's champion. He gave his answer to the handful of begrudgers who attempted to knock him. Yeah, and again, the people did speak. They kept you in. Absolutely. When cynics like me were saying, he's going to be gone.
I absolve you, Ryan. I absolve you.
Weight off my
shoulders. Oh, there you go.
I'm a new man.
Hallelujah.
What is it that makes people feel, says the text, that they can be so nasty, and it doesn't have consequences on the person targeted? They lack empathy. They can't put themselves in the other person's shoes. Is this as endemic in other countries? We've always been a nation of begrudgers. I don't know. I don't have a comparative analysis, so I don't know. Will Ray do any more TV work, or has he been put off by the negativity?
I've learned from the negativity, but I'd never be put off by it. You know, I don't know whether I'll. I mean, my parish is number one in my life anyway. So if there was something else out there to do, I have a few visions of different things in my head that I possibly could do.
Well, if you're getting visions, we're okay. allowed.
Yeah. But it may not happen. It may happen. And if it does, it does. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. That's okay too.
We could have a nun on the show next year. I mean,
you never know.
Well,
let's get the gender balance going on.
Exactly.
Sounds good to me.
Nuns on the run.
Yeah.
Let's have a look at that. Did you feel supported by the church in your participation?
I did indeed. Yeah. Initially, initially I was kind of, you know, betwixt and between, because, God, I was, and that was part of the thing as well. What's the people, what's the priest going to say? But I'm overwhelmed with phone calls, and my own bishop particularly. He was the first I went to when I got the invite.
Yes, yes.
And the thing he said to me was, he says, just be aware, he said, that you are going to be knocked. When you're up there, you are going to be knocked.
Okay, he was prescient.
He gave me prior warning, but he said, the important thing for you is you go and enjoy it. He says, you go and enjoy. And I think he got some emails and letters as well. I know the Cardinal Armagh certainly got letters and emails about me.
To say it, what?
To say that this is not right for the Catholic Church.
Okay, and how did the Cardinal communicate
that
to you? No,
I heard nothing from. I just heard that he got email and stuff. I just heard.
And how do you feel about that?
How do I feel about
that? Yeah, about people writing to the Cardinal.
I wouldn't be surprised if Pope Francis got something as well, you know. But I'm still just an ordinary priest doing my ordinary work, getting on with it. Yeah. And if I cannot, a priest can play tennis, can play golf. I just like to sing and dance.
Okay, that's a fair cop. Ray, it's been good to see you. Thanks for coming in today.
Ray.
And
thanks.
Well done. And, you know, you need to be strong and under the circumstances and... you know the expression, don't let the bastards get you down. Excuse the language, but it is from an ancient Latin quote, so you don't understand what I mean. It's not trying to be gratuitous. And there's great truth in that because there is a lot of goodness in the world, a lot of non-toxic people. Yeah. But the loud, angry, noisy mob will be there. We just have to try and see if we can put a lid on that. Kylie, thank you for coming in to see us today.
Thank you.
And you're still dancing, of course.
I am still dancing.
You'll be there next week.
Definitely, I'll be there next week. And then I'll see Ray again in the finals.
I'll be there next week too.
But you won't be dancing.
The final, we are
the finals, yes.
The final week we are dancing.
So you'll
dancing.
Go next week just to see what's going on.
I'm going into the audience, and I just was sitting in the audience the other day just watching some of the pros were doing their dance. Wouldn't it be lovely to be here just watching this? And now it's going to happen next weekend now.
And who would you put your €5 on to win?
Well, I would put my €5 on any of the four, and I would just say to Kylie earlier,
not an answer.
If we could only split this crystal ball or whatever it is down in four ways and just give them each a quarter, it would be the perfect way to end the show. But it's not going to happen.
You're not
going to
give me a name for a win?
No, because they're all brilliant and I am so thrilled they're all
Kylie there. No, it's no point, is there?
No, not going to try with it. Well, I personally have a favourite too, and I'll leave it that then.
Ah, you're not going to try that. But well done to all the four.
Thanks, Ryan.
All
thanks
four
for having us.
Well done to you for coming. Thanks for your honesty much. Today and appreciate it very much. Kylie, really nice to meet you.
Yeah,
much later than I expected to meet you, but we got there.
Got there in the end.
Thank you both very much. All right, the time is 9 minutes to 10 o'clock. Now, let me go to Singapore, which has been held as something of a model in its approach to tackling the coronavirus. An Irish man by the name of Cameron O'Connor is in that tiny city-state with a population close to our own. Cameron, good to talk to you. Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning. Tell us a little bit about Singapore, if you wouldn't mind, please, and their approach to the COVID-19 virus.
Hey, Ryan. How are you? Good morning. It's 20 past five here in the afternoon. Singapore, we get we about 4 weeks ahead of Ireland. We were one of the first countries to get it, Singapore being a big transport and tourist hub. We got cases in here very early, and we had our own little panic in the toilet roll as well. But the government kicked in. There's a background here of handling things like SARS, so you're used to when you get off a plane, there is a temperature controls. And they have this government messaging system.
I think the line is just... you're back here. Keep
the
going.
The general background is we've 160 people confirmed cases. There's been three discharged today. 93 people have been discharged. Remaining hospital, 60. And there is no one's died.
Which is quite extraordinary, given the population is pretty close to ours at 5.5 million thereabouts. 160 cases reported so far, and no one dead. Given what we're looking at in Italy and most other countries around the world, that is astonishing. So, Cameron, what are they doing that is so effective? Ultimately, what are you finding? Are the habits that are helping things?
Okay, well, Dave, the government kicked in straight away with releasing lots of information. They're not battling against lots of rumours. It's strict here, and they mentioned earlier on that we won't tolerate rumours. There is a government text message every day. There's a government website, gov.sg. It's here's all the different colour codes. We're at orange, and if we move to red, this is what's going to happen. companies being told to continue to move to business continuity. You'll find some offices will have an A-B, so they'll have Team A and Team B, and Team A and B are now like meet up. So there's always continuity. The president gave a speech on put on YouTube to say that they're all critical supplies are here. They have a hospital ready to go with 330 beds. They have a really strict contact tracing system, a software system they've put in place. So anyone who is identified has it. There's an immediate contact tracing. It's quite strict. And if you can be notified that you're on a, you have to stay at home and they will check up on you if you are at home. You have to check in with them. It's quite strict if you break that quarantine. Like they have already removed some people from the country and some people being fined. So it's quite strict. Besides that, it's, you know, life carries on. You know, big events have been cancelled. There's a new normal has set in. People are, it's reinforced. There's posters everywhere about washing your hands and, you know, just being careful when if there's large groups, be sensible. There are activities going ahead. Our own St. Patrick's Day celebrations have been curtailed somewhat, but there are a few smaller events going on and people arrive and there's not much handshaking. People are being sensible. So it's both at the government side and at the individual. Every building you go into, your temperature checked on the way in and you fill out a form to say you haven't been to China and that you feel well. And that goes into a master database. So if there is any outbreaks, they know who's been in that building or in that bank or in that room or that day.
Sure. So they're completely on top of it. I suppose the flip side of this good news story is in some ways is that Singapore, you'd have freedom of speech limitations. You'd have, you know, I suppose a government, the same party, running the place for X amount of years. So it's not exactly, do you know what I'm saying? There's a democratic deficit, I suppose, but there's a health bounce.
There is. That's exactly it. And then they don't make any excuses about that. They've got their own, they got their own version of my fits all. But it helps in this situation. Like the newspapers are, they'll tell you a lot of the news. It's very open and transparent what's going on.
Yeah.
But there isn't as many, you know, opinion pieces.
And you've got children, Cameron. So do they go to an international school there in Singapore? And how does that work in terms of, because a lot of people talk about schools
indeed
here.
Yeah. They do indeed. About 3 million people here are citizens, and 3 million are foreign workers. So a lot of expats here, and they go to an expat school. They are on the way into school every day. Their temperature checked. There is constant communication in the school. The school has a plan B to move to, if they go to the next level, to move to online schooling, you know, for the older ones. But there is parent-teacher meetings next week. They're all going ahead. Any of the big activities have been cancelled or postponed. And, yeah, you just get this reassurance that there, it's in control. You feel that everyone's stepping up, whether it's governmental authorities or school authorities, and it seems to be all coordinated from the central government, and everyone just is playing their part. Everyone is making sensible decisions. Like I'm on the board of the Irish Chamber of Commerce here, and we've decided to curtail certain events, and we're adapting. We're going to be putting on some virtual events in the future. So everyone's adapting to a new normal, but there's no panic.
What's a virtual event, Cameron?
A webinar.
Okay,
yeah,
I understand.
A webinar. Yeah.
What happens? A lot of people are freaking out because, and thankfully, I'm not online. But a lot of people, when I say online, on social media, because they're reading, you know, gossip and rumors and misinformation. How do you approach? How are they approaching that in Singapore? In terms, you mentioned briefly there about rumors. I know there was a rumor about it going around that a maid had died after contracting the virus from her boss
was,
and so on.
Yeah, there was a rumor went around that a maid had died and contacted her boss had been to China. And the government immediately came out with these text messages that go to pretty much everyone saying, it's not true, they died of something else, we've tested it. And we remind you about the penalties for starting misinformed rumors if we can catch you.
Okay, fascinating time. But I'm glad to hear that it's all under control and you sound nice and calm yourself, Cameron. So appreciate your time this morning. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Ryan.
Nice one. Thanks very much, Cameron O'Connor, joining us from Singapore, where they have got it right. As I say, democratic deficit, but certainly they're on top of the health situation. Sounds very calm indeed. Now, I want to talk to Marion. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Thanks for taking our call this morning. You wrote us an astonishing email, if I may say so, after you heard Olivia Staunton talk to us last week, who was telling us about her poor brother who had been the victim of a hit and run, and they still don't know who did that. Can I ask you, Marion, when you listened to that story, was it hard for you to listen to that story, or did you just keep going?
No, it stopped me on my tracks. It was very hard to listen to, and it brought me right back to my own family's situation quite some years ago, but it never really changes, no matter how many years ago it is, you know.
There were nine of you in the family, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Growing up on the Falls Road in Belfast, which we're all very well familiar with. Would you tell us a little bit about what happened and bring us back to that day, if you don't mind?
Well, on the 12th of January 1987, my three brothers and my brother's brother-in-law went to the local GAA club to watch some GAA, the Sunday game. And they were there about an hour, and they decided they'd just go home again. And this was in the local GAA. And it's like an extension of the Falls Road, so it's, you know, it's like the houses have been built so the country's not, you know, it's not countryside anymore, but sure, the roads were still small. And so they come out of there, and they crossed the road, and it was quite a small road, and they were crossing two by two, you know, two just behind the other. And a car came careering up the road and knocked the four of them down. And my three brothers were all, well, the two of them were knocked like 30 feet in the air and down the road. And I got a phone call the next morning to say that two of the three of them were in intensive care. For Eamon, Fergus, Vincent were my three brothers. Yeah. The youngest one, Vincent, had minor injuries, and the other two, Fergus and Eamon, were in intensive care. And Fergus lived 3 weeks. He had a head injury, never regained consciousness, and he died on the 6th of February, which was a big blow to all of us, but we didn't get time to grieve for him because Eamon was still in the next room in intensive care.
How old was Fergus, Marion? Do you mind me
asking? He was 29.
Okay. And Eamon was just down
31.
Okay.
Well, he had his 31st birthday in intensive care. He was getting better. He had multiple organ injuries, and he was, you know, well, the Royal Hospital in Belfast were amazing. They did everything they could. He was getting better. He'd been intubated. He'd started to sit up. He was talking a little bit. He was having little sips of juice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after Fergus died, like, Vincent looked at us all when we were standing outside intensive care waiting to go in to see Eamon and saying, look, Fergus is dead. We can't do anything about that. We're going to have to work really hard and get Eamon well. And things were doing okay, and then it got took a downturn, and he got septicemia. Mm. And because he had so many injuries, they couldn't figure out where the septicemia was coming from. So in the end, on the 16th of March, they told us they were going to amputate his leg because they thought that's where the infection was coming from. So they amputated his leg on the 17th of March, and he died on the 28th of March.
Oh, no.
And my father always felt that that was the final obscenity for Eamon because both Eamon and Vincent were marathon runners.
And he couldn't, the mere thought of such a part of him being taken away.
They can do wonderful things now, but in 1987, losing your leg was pretty devastating for anybody, you know. So we think he stopped fighting. He also knew that Fergus was dead. They had said, you know, that they felt it was better that he was told. But when he was told, he said, yeah, he knew because Fergus was in the room next door in intensive care and the light went out in the room. So he said he knew. And between that and the amputation was like, we think he stopped fighting. So, you know, we then tried to proceed to grieve for both of them. Mm-hmm. which was very difficult. And, you know, everybody has their own way of grieving. But it just goes on and on and on. And everybody's gone on with their lives. And we've had families and children and grandchildren. And yeah. But when, you know, when we get together as a family now, there's just this huge, big void that never, it can't be replaced. And, like, you know, when you say hit and run to people, or you say somebody was knocked down in the car, people are sympathetic and they say that's awful, and they move on with their lives, which is what people do. But where, when they didn't die outright, we often wondered would have been better off if they had died straight away, but that doesn't serve any purpose either,
no,
you know.
No, but I'm assuming it haunts you.
Yes, it does.
And it does. The story haunts you. If we all pause for a moment and thought, especially if we have brothers and sisters, if one of them died at that age and in those circumstances, we'd be ruined. And then if we thought we'd lose two...
That was just beyond comprehension.
That's what I'm thinking.
One was bad enough, but to lose both of them. And then Eamon, the second one that died, left three small children.
Okay.
And he was buried on a Tuesday, and his little girl was three on the Thursday.
There are no words for that sort of tragedy.
And I did. Sorry, Olivia, did you say that girl was called?
Yes, Olivia Staunton.
Yeah, Olivia. I just thought, you know, I thought it was very sad that she thought that she had hoped that somebody would write an anonymous letter and say, "It was me. I know I did it." And yet, the guy that knocked my brother down was caught. He tried to get his car fixed locally and said he had hit a tree. And the mechanic got suspicious, and he knew my oldest brother. And he told him, so he went to the police, and the guy was got. But he went to court with a social worker and said he had problems. And he got a 12-month suspended sentence and fined £200.
Suspended sentence?
Suspended, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, when you see the devastation that was left, and it wasn't even just my family, it was, you know, because there were so many of us, you know, we had so many friends and relations, and, you know, it devastated so many people. And I don't think people know, people have that realization. Mm.
Did you know the man?
No, he was local, but we only knew him to see.
And what became of him?
Oh, well, he was in jail a few years later for another crime he had committed, and he got out of that. And then it's very bizarre, but he committed suicide. And the day he committed suicide was the day we were burying my father.
Oh, good Lord, what a bizarre...
And somebody came in and told us that, and I used bad language and said, I wish he would go away and let me bury my father in peace. I didn't want to hear his name lifted.
And
you know, but it's such a small community, you know, that...
I understand.
It's just the trail of disaster that is left behind. And never... that can never be repaired, you know. I mean, Vincent, my youngest brother, the one that survived, he described it as losing both his arms when they died, because they were always together. They were known as the three wise men because they were always together. But, you know, and he had a young family as well. Did his best to get on with his life, and he did, and he does. But, you know, for quite some time afterwards, he would go missing in the middle of the night. And he was found in the graveyard.
He was demented with grief.
Yeah, he was found in the graveyard at least two or three times, sitting at the grave. And you have to remember, this was Belfast when the trouble was still on. So if the army had to come across him, he might not get out of the graveyard either.
What was your mother's take on all of this? And in fact, particularly if your mother was trying to bury your father, and then hearing that news about the man who committed the initial crime on your family.
Well, we didn't tell my mother when we heard that this guy had committed suicide. We didn't tell my mother that the day my father was buried. Okay. But my mother, she was a very sterling woman, and she was Catholic, but I always thought she was one of the most Christian people that I had ever met.
Yes.
And no, and she kept going. She kept going, but I remember... the day my second brother died, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. So my husband and myself took our three small children to a shopping centre to walk around to do something. And I remember walking around the shopping centre with the tears rolling down my face and my three-year-old boy walking, toddling in front of me. And all I could think was, my mother has lost two sons. I only have one. What would I do if I lost him? And that has never left me either, you know. But my mother worried about the anger and the hatred that, you know, people felt for towards this guy that knocked them down. And yet she always felt that that hatred would eat you up if you didn't let it go. And in the end, before many years later, but in the end, my mother actually had masses said for him, the guy that knocked them down.
Did she really?
Yes, because she felt that, again, as I say, that the hatred would eat them up, eat us up if we didn't let go. And unfortunately, she said she'd rather be the son of, she'd rather be the mother of her sons than the mother of somebody who used a lethal weapon to kill and ruin so many lives.
Do you remember Gordon Wilson?
I do indeed. I do indeed.
It sounds like your mother.
Yes. Yes.
You mean to forgive in the face of unforgivable acts is, as you say, she, whatever about a Catholic, a stunning Christian.
Oh, she was one of the most Christian people I have ever met in my life.
Yeah.
You know, but it's as I say, it's when people say, oh, somebody was knocked down or somebody was speeding, it doesn't sound trivial, but it doesn't just seem to...
It's neat.
Yes, it's tidy.
It's tidy for us to
and
say
it was
to
all
you.
Very messy.
Yeah. And now, exactly, it just has that lovely abstract sort of like hit and run,
and
car
you move
accident,
on.
And that's it suits us as the people trying to sympathise with you.
Yes.
But you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, and now let me say whether it was my family situation or Olivia's, or people living in a war situation,
yeah,
or people who lose loved ones in unforeseen circumstances. Nobody has the monopoly on grief. My grief is not more important than the next person's or that. But it's just when you were talking about the topic of hit and run, I just felt that's exactly as you said, you know, it is so neat and tidy. And the devastation and the trail of disaster that's left behind is indescribable.
Your sister Eileen got in touch with us.
Yes, she sent you an email after.
She sent
I
us
did.
An email. I mean, obviously, the impact of all of your on your family. She was 21. All she wanted to do was travel, but everything stopped.
Well, she was living in Dublin at the time as well, because I'd been here quite a while. She'd come to Dublin to move on and get a career, and she was doing quite well, and she thought she'd travel and get the life experience of that. And then the morning we got the phone call, she went home that day. I went home eventually, but she went home that day. And she stayed home. She never left. And she went home to my parents. And she stayed there. And with my other sisters, she nursed my father till he died. And, you know, her life disappeared as it should have, you know, as she had planned it out for somebody that was 21, 22 and everything ahead of her. And it just never happened.
Everything changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably kind of probably not a very nice observation, but I often find when people are robbed of somebody so young that a little bit of a light goes out in them.
Yes, it does.
And I'm not saying that it finishes people off altogether, but I just feel sometimes you meet people who've suffered this unspeakable grief, and you can't help but think, you know, if everyone in your family that or people you love are candles, just one was put out, or two in your case.
Well, and
it's a different kind of light. I don't know if that's gobbledygook, but it just
yes, it is, and as I say, you know, you're marked for life.
I think so.
And everything you do in your life is, you know,
informed by that.
By that, it is. And now, I mean, it was 1987, and my children were 3, 5, and 6 at the time.
Mm.
But my children have grown up, and other children in the family, the grandchildren it would be, have grown up still knowing Fergus and Eamon because they're talked about all the time. And we talk about, you know, something silly that happens or a great football match or, you know, you'd say, oh, Eamon would have loved that, or, you know, Fergus would have been amused
at that. Keep the story. Do me a favour, Marion, would you?
Yeah.
Tell me something beautiful about Fergus and Eamon.
Oh, well.
Start with Fergus.
Fergus was the quiet one and everybody wanted to mind him. And he was he was dark and had very dark brown eyes, lovely black hair. And the other two hated him because they were going bald. And he didn't really care how he looked. You know, he just muddled on through and he always looked good. And Vincent, particularly the younger one, there was always rows between those two because Fergus couldn't be bothered buying fancy clothes. And Vincent was dressed to the nines and he used to steal Vincent's clothes. So there was murder with that. But he had a wicked sense of humour and he was wonderful with the small children. And all the women called him Dimitri.
OK, so he had that dark features.
Yeah, and you know, and quiet and gentle, you know. Yeah. Eamon was, he was 6 foot odd. He had red hair and he was known to his friends as Rooster. And he could have went to the pub and sat in company. Because we were all so close together, we all went out together with our partners and husbands, wives, whatever. But Eamon could have held court and he could have told stories like... do you know the way Billy Connolly would have went off on a rambling story before he got to the punchline?
Yeah.
Eamon could do that. And he could keep it up for like 10 or 15 minutes and everybody would be waiting for the punchline. But he never lost their attention, you know?
Yeah.
And he was wickedly funny.
Well, you know? I feel like you've introduced your brothers to us today.
Okay.
That was lovely.
Okay.
Thank you, Marion.
Yeah, they're still around.
They're still around. They're still in the air and they joined us here in a way this morning, which I think is kind of gorgeous too. Thank you for telling us your story. That wasn't easy, Marion, but I think it's important and we appreciate your time.
Not at all. Only delighted to be given the opportunity and just for people to realise that cars can be lethal weapons.
That's a true story. Well, the best of luck to you and to your family and to thanks to Eileen also for her email. And mind yourself and hopefully we'll cross paths someday.
Thank you very much indeed.
Take care, Marion.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. 9 minutes to 10. Yvonne Redden, good morning to you, Yvonne.
How are you, Ryan? I'm delighted to be on your show.
Well, I'm delighted to talk to you and thanks for your lovely message that you sent in to us about life in the community. Tell us a bit about yourself and why you did get in touch.
Well, I wanted to get in touch. Basically, I wanted to talk about the value and importance of community centres in communities in general.
Yeah.
Because I just feel they're very underrated and people don't know enough about what they offer. And they're for everybody. And I actually teach in one at the minute in Ballybracket Place. It's a centre called SWAN. It's Southside Women's Action Network.
Yep.
They're part of a huge, big project nationwide. They've 17 projects. And I do a creative writing course there. And I do it voluntary. And sometimes you only have to pay a little fee of €5. Just to tell people in communities that there is these services there. A lot of people don't actually know they're there. And I think it's for support. And especially now, the way things are at the minute, everyone's been advised to work from home. The kids could be off school longer. I think people need to turn to somewhere for information and not just get it from social media because that's causing a moral panic.
Yeah.
You know, and get the right information from the right place.
Humans talking to humans. Shock.
And not robots.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you know? I hear you.
And they're not getting the right information and people are getting scared, and rightly so, but get the information from the right place. And community centres would be detrimental to that.
Tell us about yourself.
Where do I start?
I don't know. Start at the beginning and we'll see where we go from there.
It'll take a lot longer than 10 minutes or so, Ryan. Well, okay. I suppose I have a background. I was away in Australia for 9 years. I came back 15 years ago. And I came back, I was kind of fairly depressed. 6 months after I was home, my mother got Alzheimer's. A month after that, my dad with throat cancer.
Oh,
so I found myself in a very low place. And I had a 3-year-old son as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of needed something to get me out of that and to get going. And I went looking for a course. And I found one in Dunleary College, a further education journalism course. I was always interested in papers, how they're put together, human stories, stories in general. I love it.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has a story to tell.
For sure.
So I did a course there. And I went down and did another year there. There was a link. And then they were very supportive. The teachers were amazing. I can't say enough about further education teachers. They're brilliant.
Great.
And they got me a link into DIT in Ainger Street, where I continued on and got a degree in journalism. So at the tender age of 40, my ad. Mm-hmm. So I was a late bloomer, but I mean, I found what I wanted to do, but later in life. And then a year after that was my graduation. And 2 months after my graduation, I found I was pregnant with twins.
Right.
So after all that hard work, I was like, oh, my God. And I'm still in shock over it, you know. And I already had one child, and then I was going to have twins. I mean, how did that happen?
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, my God. So the shock, I was shocked, I have to say. I had my twins at 42, and they're six now. That was 6 years ago, yeah. So I was a late bloomer.
Oof, I'm exhausted just thinking about
it. I know. That's what I'm only touching on it, literally.
And how were the twins? I mean, was it a tale of two cities or were they both the same?
They are the tale of two cities for sure. Oh, my God. You know, they always say twins are rated the same and similar. Mine are completely different. It's just like having two different children. Completely different personalities,
yeah.
To say the least. So they are special, of course. But they're completely different characters. They're not alike at all.
And which one do you prefer?
Ah, don't do that.
Okay, so you found yourself
the boy,
with... The boy, the natural son and heir.
Ah, stop, yeah.
So you have the twins, yeah. You've got your eldest, and...
He was 11 at the time. I had an 11-year-old, he's 17 this year, he's 18 this year. So I had an 11-year-old, found myself with twins. I knew my relationship with the twins' dad wasn't going to last, and it didn't.
Okay.
I knew deep down I was going to be lone parenting, which I had been doing 95% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really, really, it was a struggle, you know, and I just want to say to people out there who may be in the same situation I was in, staying at home. I mean, I did isolate myself purely because I had to. The thought of going outside the door, I didn't drive at the time, was just too daunting for me, bringing two kids in a bulky pram, getting on a bus. The bus was full. There was a pram on already. They wouldn't let you on. It was all these little dilemmas that just made me want to stay in more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the more I stayed in, the more I got too much into myself and isolated myself.
Yeah.
Maybe too much.
You self-perpetuate, you know? the need to be alone.
Yeah, mm. I think so. And it was only because I had to and I was exhausted and I was going through such horrendous times with sleep, with training, with all the things that you go through with babies. And I always remember my sister saying to me, you have to get yourself back out there. You have to get out and socialise. But I just couldn't. I just couldn't.
Okay.
So I set up a blog because I love writing about my own experiences and being truthful about it. I used to go to parks and ask other mothers, how are you getting on? And they'd be saying, I'm grand. I'm going, you're not grand. I said, you know, I could have been an extra for the Walking Dead series. I looked like a zombie. I was knackered. You know, and I think people need to be more truthful and honest about how it really is. And I was. So I set up my own blog and it's called sleepingwiththedishes.com. And I have a Facebook page that links in with that. Just about my own experiences with toilet training, with fussy eating, with no sleep. My daughter screamed for about a year. I didn't sleep for 6 months to a year. You know, just all about that stuff. And that's,
and it's called Sleeping with the Dishes?
It's called sleepingwiththedishes.com,
yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it's just a pun off Sleeping with the
Dishes. No, I know what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that I know what it is. I just admire your punnery.
Yeah,
your punmanship is impressive.
Yeah.
And
I love thinking of puns and thinking of headlines and stories. The
okay.
Journalist.
You obviously have journalistic blood flowing through your veins, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I think so. I love it, yeah.
So you take us then from the blog. That obviously helped you like shine a torch out of the darkness then a little bit.
Yeah, it did. And there was, you know, I felt that there was no light at the end of the tunnel, basically. But I have to tell people that there is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that already from having a child, that it does get better. But when you're in that hole and you just can't get out of that bubble of pure exhaustion and overwhelmment as well of having two new babies to look after, you know, you have to find another way to get support if you don't have enough, you know. And I had to find another network of friends that understood what I was going through and understood the black circles under the eyes, understood the food all over my jumper. They didn't have to ask questions. So I did.
Yeah.
And when the kids turned three, they went to creche for the free ECHI scheme that was available. And to me, that was just heaven. I had 3 hours available in the morning to just get my head together. And I approached the manager in the local creche they went to about, was there a support group there for parents like myself? And there wasn't. So I helped set one up with another lady who I met called Deirdre Brennan. She will be a friend for life. And I met this lady. We don't see each other a lot, but we ring each other once a week to check in on each other, see how we're doing. She's a parent and alone as well.
Mm-hmm.
Two beautiful children, Carl and Rosalind. I just had to say their names because I said to them I would.
Good.
But, you know, this is what you do. You have to go out and find a new network of friends, unfortunately. Because your older ones have gone through the parenting thing. They're nearly there. I was starting again and my friends were nearly finished. It was a tough one and I knew I had to do something. So the parent group we set up, it was very hard to engage people in the community. We set up, we had pamper days, we had raffles. You have to dangle a carrot to get people in. And I just don't understand that, why people needed that to come into a community centre to find support. And it still baffles me. You know, I teach a class, I have two students, but I go every week and I do a voluntary because people are coming to learn and I'm a teacher and I want to do teaching in community. I feel drawn to that area. So, but I don't know why people don't see the importance of these community centres.
Maybe, you know? Maybe there's a sense that people see the dark circles under the eyes and the food on the jumper. No. I'm actually being serious. I think they see the people, and I'm talking about the people with the dark eyes and with the food. They might see it as a weakness and as failure, and they don't want to share that with other people. And actually, they should be marks of honour because, you know, you're bringing up a child and you're doing it on your own or with somebody. It doesn't matter. It's a huge thing to do. But there is a sort of, and I don't think there's anything to do with an online thing. I'm not getting into that now. I think in life there is a kind of competitive snobbery in terms of not wanting to admit that everything isn't quite what it seems.
Absolutely. But I found writing about it for me was my form of counselling. I mean, I'm a good talker now, but I probably didn't talk enough. I mean, you know, and the writing, I think, got me through. Writing about it on my Sleep With The Dishes blog, I don't have loads of followers, but I just got it up there. I got it off my chest.
What's social prescribing? Your friend who's a nurse. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So my friend I was talking about earlier on, Deirdre Brennan, she's a nurse. She's trying to get back into working and education. Education's empowerment. I can't go on about it enough. It's brilliant. She's trying to do the same with her nursing. So she was doing a course and they had to do a presentation. She asked me to help her put a PowerPoint together because I love doing all that.
Good.
And I said, okay, great. What do you want to talk about? Tell me a bit about it. And she was telling me about social prescribing. Basically what it is, you know, when you go to your GP and the GP will probably prescribe, I don't want to say this, but maybe antidepressants.
If you're bad,
You might not need that. Yeah, exactly.
If you're feeling bad.
But this social prescribing is the GP actually prescribing you to go to your community centre in your local community and see what's available there. Join a course. Get socialised and get mingling with somebody. And they've piloted it here, I think, already. I've looked it up. And it's working. Instead of going to down the road of tablets or whatever, go and do something. Join a group. Talk to people. It's the old back to basics of talking, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what social prescribing is.
Okay.
And it's all community-based, as well.
And community is the word. And because community, some words can be a bit abstract. It's a word I use a lot when you say community. It's kind of, what does that mean? But actually, it just means being civil and being kind and giving a damn about that person across the road who's 88 and who seems hale and hearty, but just saying, I'm going down. Do you need toilet paper? You know, do you need some hand sanitizer? You know, it's that basic human interaction.
Especially now, checking in on your neighbours, checking in on mums on their own, checking in on the elderly, call in with a box of tea bags. People will be delighted. You know, you don't know. And people might be able to get out to hear about what's going on globally with coronavirus. They might just need a little bit more information. So it is, going back to basics, calling in on them people that need it. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, somebody says you should be appointed the Minister for Children, Families and Mental Health.
Lovely.
But obviously, you know, you sound like somebody, like one of those active citizens. And by those, I mean people who care about the world, the country, who would love to be involved. I mean, I'd love to see you in local politics, for starters. You should run for council in some shape or form and work your way up.
Yeah,
I mean, I think you're totally articulate. You give a damn. You've got the social service in your running through your veins. So think about it, will you?
I sure will, yeah.
Yeah,
thank you.
I think you should. It's good to talk to you, Yvonne.
Thank you. And hopefully we'll talk again, Ryan. That'd
we will. You know we will, for sure. And this is the beginning of our conversations.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to get in touch with me, I'm on LinkedIn. My email is yredden1@gmail.com.
Yeah.
I'm open there. Contact me wherever way you want to.
And you're Facebook in Ballybrack, Killiney, that
I'm
part
of town. I'm in Ballybrack, Killiney, on the round, I'm a local girl, And I don't mind talking about everything. Sharing your story. Sharing is caring. My sister always said to the kids, sharing is
that's
caring.
The truth.
And it's the same with stories. if you can help somebody with your story, that's really what I'd love to do.
Sounds good to me. Yvonne, it's a real pleasure talking. Do you mind yourself and your gorgeous kids?
Thank
and
you
we'll
so
see
much,
you soon.
Ryan.
Okay,
thank
bye
you.
For now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Yvonne. At 9:33, the text number is 51551. Now, there are channels on your TV. I call them the Shackletons because you have to go quite high to get them. And you have to go travel quite far to get them. And if you do, you'll know programmes like American Pickers, two guys in a van travelling around junkyards and hoarders' houses to find the treasures that they can sell on. It's intriguing look into people's stuff. And there's a whole raft of these shows. There's Salvage Hunters is another. And now there's Irish Pickers, at last, which features Ian Dowling of RareIrishStuff.com and his team looking for what treasures they can find. So we asked Ian to come and join us this morning to tell us everything. Good morning, Ian.
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for coming in to see us this morning. I'm dying to find out what this is. Before we get into the programme, how did you end up as a picker? So tell us a bit about what you've been doing before this.
Well, I was always into buying and selling. I was always had a knack for kind of buying something for a pound and selling it for two or three.
Yeah.
And I was always kind of involved in, you know, sales and stuff like that. So just basically during the recession, you know, I think most people had to kind of
find a new life.
Box. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd come back from Australia and I kind of went back to the one skill that I really have, which is buying and selling. And that's what kind of started all off really for me, you know.
All right. And I think like all great ideas, it probably started in a pub with a mate. And
it did, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I knocked up to a mate of mine one Friday night or something like that. We went for a couple of pints up in Scholar's Pub in Firhouse.
Yep.
And we were just sitting there eating bacon fries, having a chat. And
quality night out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then the GA sweepstakes was being like, they were doing the rounds with the raffle tickets. And yeah, just bought a ticket. Didn't think about it. Went on with my bacon fries, my Guinness. Went home Monday morning. You know, at that time, Monday morning, yeah, it was kind of no job. I was in negative equity at the time as well. So it was kind of a, you know, and then I got a call just to say I won 13,500 nice. in the sweepstakes.
Okay.
And that was it. And that's what I used then to kind of buy some antiques.
Okay. So when you say antiques, what sort of era were you interested in?
Well, when I say antiques, I mean, it could be anything really. Just something that's interesting, that's old, that has a bit of history to it. It's not necessarily your kind of like standard antiques, like brown furniture, porcelain, silver. I'm not really into that kind of stuff. It's a bit more boring to me. I like kind of stuff that has...
character.
Character. And it doesn't have to have a kind of a huge monetary value attached to it. It just has to have... It could be worth 50 quid and I get the same kick out of that as, you know, many people would out of something that might be worth a lot of money.
Give us a sense of where do you go to find the stuff and what are you looking for ultimately?
I'm looking for something different. I think you can get the best margin out of items when it's something that there's no comparison to really. And, you know, that way then you can maybe name your price really if somebody likes it. And,
yeah.
And that's kind of one of the criteria that I always look for.
And where do you go to find the things you want?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a variety of sources really. Dundeal and adverts, antique shops, auction houses, word of mouth. Just kind of getting out there really. And then once you're kind of in the... You know, once you kind of get into the business, you kind of develop more and more leads as time goes by.
And then you can stumble across something amazing, such as the little briefcase you bought for 50 quid.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good example of something that doesn't necessarily have a big monetary value, but I see a huge value in it. And you see this kind of stuff in auction rooms all around the country, and not just in this country. It's quite a common situation where you'd find personal possessions belong to somebody, you know, just been put into an auction house and sold for a song, you know. And I find that kind of I love to find stuff like that and then give it a new home and connect it with somebody who's going to treasure it and then, you know, take a bit of profit out of it as well. But I get a real kick out of kind of connecting,
finding
something.
So you got this briefcase and you opened it up and suddenly inside you find somebody's life story.
Yeah, so yeah, that's a good example of it. It was just, 50 quid. It was a briefcase. I had a quick look in it before the auction kicked off, and it was a man's medals and papers and photographs and pretty much his whole life in one little case. You can just kind of imagine him popping it under the bed and keeping it somewhere safe. And, you know, it's really moving when you open something like that and have a look through it. And
World War II?
World War II, yeah. And, it was just, I still have that because I wouldn't... again, like the resale value of stuff like that, you'd be surprised at how little, you know, stuff like that would go for.
Yeah.
But
because I watch a lot of these things, like the whites would do in a collectibles. Yeah. You probably see that one.
Yeah.
And I'm intrigued by sometimes the value of something I thought would be worth a lot, like a medal from World War II,
yeah,
you'll get for 50, 60 quid. And yeah, I thought, God, when you think of what people suffered and went through to get the medal, and really, there's not much. I would have thought there was an awful lot of value to it, but not really.
Yeah, I know.
So you see, and then you'll see something ludicrous to me, like a vase.
Yeah, it could be a silver spoon or something. Yeah, and it could be worth 15 grand.
That's right,
you know what I mean? Yeah. And like I had like a whole bundle of love letters from World War II. And I mean, stuff like that, again, you could pay 20 quid for a whole life's worth of love letters between a couple that is just so, you know,
moving
and just special, you know, and so if it gets lost, you know, somewhere along the line and gets found in an auction house, I'd like to bring it and connect it to somebody who would appreciate it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You had a copy of the Good Friday Agreement, was it?
I did, yeah. That was the one that kind of got away. I sold that too fast, you know. It was signed by everybody, all the parties involved in the negotiations.
Where did you get it?
I got it from a man out in Galway, and at that time, that was kind of in the early days of kind of doing this, and I got a lot of my leads through Dundeal and adverts, and during the recession at that time, there was a lot of people selling stuff.
And you got too low a price for it, as you see it.
Yeah, well, I flipped it. It was a good price at the time, but you know, it was something that was only going to appreciate in value and become more and more special. It's just such a kind of a pivotal, you know, piece really for Ireland, and something that I think most Irish people would really kind of treasure.
One sold for 16,000 euros.
That's right, yeah.
You a bit sick?
It does, yeah. But you know what? I'm going to get one someday.
I'm going to get
one back, yeah.
What else do you, what other things have you bought that you love or intriguing finds along the way?
Well, this...
You've got a box behind you. Yeah, sorry, it looks like a cigarette box, selling box.
Well, this is actually a whiskey vending machine from 1971. And I bought 160 of these from a man down in Kilkenny. And
keep talking, looking over here because
So you put in 3 tenpenny coins and you get a 35 milliliter glass of whiskey.
I've never seen one of those.
I know, yeah.
A whiskey bottle dispenser. Like, we need that like a hole in our heads in this country, but
they
did a job once upon a time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a pretty cool idea, you know. I mean, they never really took off. And the man I bought them from, his father in law had brought them in. From the UK, I think they were made, and tried to get the idea going here.
And how many of those boxes did you buy?
I bought about 160 of those.
Vending machines.
Pardon me?
They're vending machines.
Yeah, they're vending machines. Yeah. And I've about 15 left. So they're kind of...
Okay, this is corona-friendly vending, because 3 coins gets you your whiskey and you don't have to touch anyone or see anyone.
It could be the future, yeah.
You could be back in vogue again. So who bought them and why?
Well, if you're a whiskey enthusiast, if you've got a home bar, or if you're a publican, like if you own a pub, you can, you know, put this on a shelf or something. Or
it's a quirky curio.
Yeah, it's a cute conversation piece.
Okay.
You know, and people come in, they'll have a chat about it. What's that? And then you'll have a 5-minute conversation. You'll think that's brilliant. That's, you know what I mean? And then that's it. You know,
Mustang Sally's pub in Cork.
That's
of interest to you, or it was.
Yeah, that was one of the spots we went to during the TV show. It was a man named Kieran Murray, and he was a club promoter and he owned a kind of a nightclub restaurant in Limerick City for a while. And that was one of the spots during the show.
How do you buy a bar?
He had a bar that was used in Mustang Sally's. And,
okay.
Yeah, and it was like a little, kind of it's the size of a home bar. And I bought that on the show for 700 quid. The interesting thing about that was that Oliver Reed had a few drinks at that bar.
Good.
So that kind of helped.
And you sold it to a man in America for how much?
Yeah, the client in the States in Minnesota, and he 5 grand.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's a nice time.
That's a nice way. So the program you've just mentioned, tell us about that. That's the one with the Irish Pickers, right? That
we're going to see. Irish Pickers, yeah.
And that's going to be happening next Thursday on Blaze, which is Sky Channel 164. I'm definitely going to tune in for that. What does that see you do? What happens in the program?
Well, it basically just it's like a fly on the wall, I guess. Just following me and my best mate Mark Butterley, around Ireland, we kind of. It just follows kind of what I do, really, in many ways. And but we kind of, yeah, we travel around, we meet interesting people. It really captures the kind of scenery of Ireland and the history, the folklore, the culture, the people, you know.
You bought trench art, right, at one stage?
Oh, yeah,
from World War One.
Yeah, the Battle of the Somme.
Where'd you get it?
I got that from a dealer out in Athenry. And that was a really beautiful piece.
And
yeah.
Did you sell it on, or?
I still have that. It's something that, you know, I kind of get a real a joy out of holding, like a kid who gets a new toy, and I kind of, you know, enjoy having it for a while, like a caretaker or something.
Yeah, I like
before
I like that,
pass it on, and that's something I really, really like. It was a shell that was turned into a lamp, basically the base of a lamp, and you saw a lot of that kind of stuff in World War One.
Yeah,
when people were bored out of their heads, sitting in trenches. Do you know what I mean? It's just something to occupy the mind, and that's what that was.
There's they often sell prisoner art from the Troubles as well. That's another.
That's
thing.
Right.
I
yeah.
see rubber bullets even.
Yeah,
it will go for a couple of hundred quid. And,
yeah,
you know, because and as you say, these things. I've bought a few bits and pieces like the things you're talking about every now and again for maybe 100, 150 quid. I wouldn't be going mad, but I put them in my house because they are talking conversation
yeah,
pieces.
Exactly.
I don't want like a massive piece of art or whatever, even though I wouldn't mind one, but I don't want one. But I do love curios.
Well, they tell their own story. I mean, some people would buy a piece of art and there'd be a story behind that or the artist's story behind it. But there's something so real about an object or, you know, something that's passed through many hands, has seen a lot, and just having that in your home. And my house is full of stuff like that, you know.
I can imagine your house. Yeah, it doesn't feature in the programme.
No, it doesn't.
They should. And there's lovely. One of the things I love is history, like letters from Daniel O'Connell.
Yeah.
Or signatures. I'm fascinated by letters or signatures or a signature from Arthur Griffith or Charles Stewart Parnell. These often come up, and I've come very close to. I love something like that on my wall, but I love the closeness to history, to see the ink of the pen,
absolutely,
of the man who wrote, who signed, and who's so important to a country. Do you feel a certain strain of patriotism running through your job, even if it is just going to salvage yards? But do you feel that way?
Oh, definitely.
Are you protective?
Oh, well, definitely. Yeah, no, I'm fascinated by the passing of time, and I'm just kind of fascinated by Irish history and culture, and it's a weird thing. I'm really into it.
And it's good to try and keep a lot of this stuff in the country if possible.
Absolutely.
Haggling. Mm. To haggle or not to haggle, that is the question. If somebody's going in and they see that box that you showed me there and it's going for, say, 200, say, 100 euro, what should we do? Should give us some tips on
the haggle. If I'm looking for 100 quid for...
Let me just see. No, I'm coming in and I'm, despite all my showy confidence, I'm actually probably going to be a little shyer in real life. So what do I do?
Well, I think the one thing is really kind of just go in for with a low ball offer, and then that way you kind of get a reaction and kind of get the bottom line. That's
so you Marrakesh it up.
Yeah, it's kind of the way to do it, I think, if you're going to try to buy something and get the best deal on it, you know.
Don't be afraid to go.
Absolutely not. Like, you know, and most people in the trade, I mean, I certainly enjoy that kind of tussle, and most people who are in the trade, like it's par for the course.
I'm mortified by haggling. I can't do it. This is your stock and
trade. Well, this is it. I enjoy it, but I'm amazed that some people just shy away from it, because it's particularly if you're at a market or you go into an antique shop. That's the trade, and most people expect it. So you're letting people off the hook pretty easy.
If you take it at the value. And what about if you are nervous and you do want the item and you do feel it's a little out of your reach, and yet you know that you can, if you bring the price down, you'll get it, but you just have this innate nervousness. What do you do with that?
If you can't really afford what the dealer's looking for, I would just tell them straight up, listen, I'm not trying to haggle, I'm not trying to lowball, I'm just like, I've got 50 quid for this.
Good.
And I will give this a good home, and I'd really appreciate it.
Would that matter? Because
I get a massive kick out of making a profit and making money along the way. I get a big buzz out of that, but I also get a huge buzz from kind of like, connecting somebody with something that they genuinely will love. And so if that meant taking 50 quid less for something, I mean, I've done that in the past. I mean,
because you can see it in someone's eyes. They really want
this
thing.
Like, you make someone's day. They may have that for the rest of their days, and they may even pass it on, you know what I mean? So that's really kind of a privileged position to be in, that kind of, to be able to do that.
What is the worst question you can ask if you're trying to haggle? What's the do not ask question?
I just think being rude is kind of the worst thing, you know? I mean, just being rude is kind of the worst way to go about things. If you're nice and polite, no matter what it is, even if you I just think that's the best approach. To get the best results. Like,
that's how we started the program about the COVID thing. It's just everyone needs to be kind of civil.
Yeah.
And haggling doesn't need to be obnoxious.
Absolutely not. I mean, it turns people away, and people would prefer you not to get the item if you're, if you're rude about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's natural. And but if you're somebody who's nice and polite, I think that just, it's like any business really, isn't it?
It goes far. It goes far. I have an ad, Anne Tracy was on to say, I have an ad for Clark's Perfect Plug. I presume that's tobacco, is it? And it says made in Seirstod Éireann. And my grandmother wrote December 1928 on the back, and she used it to back a photograph. And it looks like maybe a first colour photo. So everyone has stuff, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah.
Addicts are heaving with it. And if they want to get rid of it, should they bring it to, like, who should they bring it to if they have all the this wonderful trove of...
Well, there's a couple of options. I mean, you can bring it to an auction house. An auction house would basically a lot of the time sell to the trade or to collectors. There's commission involved in that as well. So, but that's one option. You can sell it directly to a dealer or in Dundeal or adverts. Or you can give me a shout. And or if we're doing a season two, you can get in touch with the production company if you've got a nice big... hoard of stuff that you'd like to sell. I'd be your man.
You're the man. Ian Dowling. Irish Pickers airs at 9 o'clock Thursday 19th of March on Blaze, which is Sky Channel 164. I will be watching. A text says, always haggle. They put it on to take it off.
Absolutely.
Not a bad line, actually. I like that. Is there anything that you would love to buy that you've seen or you know will be on the market, or something that for yourself that you just haven't quite got your hands on yet?
To be honest, the number one target for me is getting a Good Friday Agreement.
You're determined to go.
Well, it is. Yeah, it's the one thing that I kind of really regret selling, and ever since it's the one thing that I want to kind of acquire again.
That's
so
funny. That's your thing.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. So someday I'll be. Yeah,
you'll hold it. Do you want to keep it, or you?
Yeah, I'd like to keep it and frame it and put it on the wall. Yeah, it's just a huge piece for in Irish history.
You got that right. Okay, Ian, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise.
We'll be watching your program.
Thanks so much.
I just love what it's about and where it's going. So good luck with it all, and thanks for coming in to see us this
morning. Thank you for having me.
Ian Dowling, live in studio this Thursday morning at 10 to 10.